side of the table. Basically, our approach was to just, you know, pretty much just listen to see what they kept offering. They offered a way lot, quite a bit.
I want to hear about that, but before we go into that, let me ask you this: how could we saw Kennedy get together with Byers and Celia Scott like a year and a half ago at Christmas and proposed the emergency shelter exceptions to the sleeping ban, camping ban controversy, and that of course was all muzzled by Councilmember Rotkin. But even if Kennedy did get together with Scott and Byers, that's only 3 votes. How? And Kennedy is going off the council, so what did you actually have in mind? Was there a 4th vote you were appealing to? Or?
Yeah, a few of them. Any one of a few of them. But you know, we also what it was accomplishing, Robert, over the summer was broadening our base to include business community, include the police community, include the park rangers. That you know that those are important essential elements of any kind of compromise in this issue.
Did anyone from the business community, the police, or the park rangers ever sit down at the table with you?
Well, actually, you know, Don Lane had the regards sent to us by Chris Quinn, head of the Downtown Association New Leaf Market. So she was with us in spirit, never managed to make the meetings.
Hmm.
Don got sick, as you know. Mm-hmm. Scott Kennedy himself broke his elbow during this process. The last meeting, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, we just all got stood up.
By?
By Kennedy and Gillette and them.
Oh, they didn't come, huh?
No, and so we've been, you know, I've been pleading with Scott to speak to me, sending him emails and so forth like that, so we're stuck. We're counting on Father Marini to, you know, either get this thing going or, you know, hey, you know, we need to raise $4,000 so we can hit the streets again.
Well, I think Scott's a busy man. Last I heard, he was on the East Coast doing some fancy negotiations after his taking out after the Beach Flats, having taken a bite out of the Beach Flats with this land trust giveaway, or this, I should say, title lands giveaway. He's now...
I don't want to mix my metaphors here, Robert.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it's like... I know Scott's a busy man, but you know everybody that was there, that was stood up at the meeting, also had either law practices, nonprofit organizations to run, you know, community service to do, were disabled, had childcare problems, had mothers in town. I mean, we all had lives to live too.
Well, wait a minute. You know, I mean, I think you should consider it an honor to be held up by Scott, stood up by Scott. I've been stood up by Scott 3 times.
Well, I was stood up by Scott Kennedy from.
On Free Radio Santa Cruz.
From May 18th until July 20th, whatever it was, before we finally got these talks really rolling. It took forever. So, I know he's a busy man, and I also don't want to attack him in any way. I think he's had enough being attacked. I want him to come back to the table.
I think that Scott has suffered enough, frankly. I do. He is not a crook. He is a good man.
Everybody's suffered enough, Robert. That's the problem.
Yeah.
You know, we've all suffered enough. This has been a real, real painful year for people on both sides of the left side of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
The left side of the aisle has both sides against itself. And it's been a year full of suffering for a lot of people. And, you know, we're sitting here at a table talking about the criminalization of homeless people and stopping it, for God's sake. Stopping the criminalization of homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, I don't care how much time and how busy the person is. He's sincere. He made sincere offers. Occupied our time and attention and energy all summer long.
Well, you say that you came to the table looking to perhaps weaken the proposal that you put out on the initiative in terms of removing the downtown as an area for people to sleep. Which, actually, I don't know, they'd sleep standing up or hanging from a sack or something. Because you cannot sleep on the ground if you lie down. It's illegal to lie down any time, day or night, in the downtown area.
You'd have to sit in a bench.
You'd have to sit on a bench, right,
to
sleep.
We weren't giving up much.
So you weren't giving up too much.
But it was an affront to the Downtown Association, I was made to believe, and then after we gave it up, they didn't consider it so much an affront after all. So, you know, then they gave us all these gives, you know.
What did they give you?
They took out sleeping as a definition of camping, period, except for on or under a car. And they gave us, so sleeping would no longer be a definition of camping. Mm-hmm. Citywide, they gave us vehicular sleeping in driveways, and they gave us vehicular sleeping in industrial parks. But
that sounds like a significant accomplishment. But
how do you
know this is from the Downtown Association?
Not from the Downtown Association. This is from all the persons represented in this.
So Don Lane really was the only one who had anything to do with the businesses downtown that spoke to you in this.
Unfortunately, we have business associations of our own mm-hmm. with the Committee on Fuel Sleeping Ban, but you know, it's obviously mm-hmm. the Downtown Association, CLIC, you know, that's been against the homeless in so many ways, and that's the CLIC we have to break and a stranglehold on decent businessmen downtown.
Mm-hmm. And so you had what, four or five meetings with all these folks? And you came up with this final language, and then you found that Kennedy would not, actually that nobody came to the last meeting except the people in favor of changing.
Let's say those affiliated with the Committee to Fuel Sleeping Ban.
Karen Gillette, Don Lane, and Scott Kennedy didn't show up.
No.
And did you talk to them afterward and find out what the problem was?
I've sent emails and phone messages, and I can't get any kind of response.
You mean Karen will not answer your phone calls?
Karen knows where I'm at.
I see. Well, this is, it's interesting to hear that the kind of good work you've been trying to do, David, around this, and it's interesting to hear that there have been so many concessions offered, but I guess you're saying that you feel negotiations have broken down, huh?
Well, they're certainly not, it's certainly not at the point where we have the police saying, yes, we support what the City Council has before it, which is where we thought we'd be by now.
Mm-hmm. And what is but you hammered out something for the City Council?
Yeah.
And so you actually have that?
It's gone through City staff. This thing has been written up by City staff, gone through the City Attorney's Office and everything.
So this is a proposal that would make it legal to sleep
anywhere in the city.
Anywhere in the city except on or under a car.
Yes.
So no more sleeping under cars, you guys. And it would also make it legal to sleep in industrial areas and on church property regardless
vehicular sleeping
regardless of the number of vehicles. So it would
also in church parking lots and organizations no matter without regard to number.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a major step forward.
I was really quite pleased. I was trying to send vibes out that, hey, you know, we're on a threshold here, guys. You know, I was even trying to tell you to be cool, you know, don't go around insulting too many people.
I'd like to point out that the first I heard of this proposal was actually 2 hours ago when you mentioned to me that you had been doing all this Metternich Kissinger-like darting back and forth with your shuttle diplomacy.
Yeah. God help us all.
And I guess the City Council, the last City Council meeting of, I guess it's the next to the last City Council meeting of the season is coming up in tomorrow, or day after tomorrow on Tuesday afternoon and evening. Are you going to be discussing this at Oral Communications?
Well, I don't know. I want to see what kind of spot I'm put on at the SCAN meeting. If you know, the SCAN wants to prioritize this issue, then I'm going to have to bring all this stuff forward. I don't, you know, Celia. I haven't even talked to Celia and Catherine about this yet.
Mm-hmm. And kind of continuing with the schedule that we have CPRB and SCAN meetings on Monday. We have a City Council meeting on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday there is the De Anza Neighborhood Association meeting, which is the candidates forum. For those who are interested, at 7 p.m. Do you know where that is?
I know it's the De Anza Neighborhood Association, the Neighborhood Community Center, you know, that trailer park out there?
Okay.
It's in the center of the trailer park.
I don't, but I hope some do. I guess
you go out into Delaware all the way to, Terrace Point.
Mm-hmm.
You go into that trailer court, and there's a community center in the center.
That'll be 7 p.m. on Wednesday. And, of course, today, from 2 to 6 at the Student Center on campus, is a Rock the Vote, correct?
I think it's more of a swing jazz the vote.
Oh, swing the vote, yes.
Swing jazz the vote, but it's like a rock the vote.
And this morning we had Bill Monig's supposed party endorsing the Crone Fitzmaurice Sugar Slate.
Yeah, I think that's really great. That's really great that Bill's come here. I know he endorsed me in my campaign 2 years ago when he did not intend to get involved in Santa Cruz City politics, but because of what, you know, the unfairness and cruelty and injustices of certain parties 2 years ago, he stepped in, and I think he's now sees it important that he steps in now. He is very much respected man in this area.
Yeah, Bill Monig, of course, was a candidate for Assembly, right?
Yes. He finished candidate for Congress, too, the first time Panetta left the seat, remember?
Hmm.
He came out of nowhere for most of us up here. We wish we'd have heard about him in time. You know?
There's also, of course, the court date for your settlement conference.
No comment at this time.
On Thursday. in court, for those who wish to sniff out just what you've been up to in terms of your assault by Sergeant Andy Crane under direction from Mayor Mike Rotkin back in 1996 in September, when actually the same issue was up, the sleeping ban,
yeah,
and the question of a peaceful if rowdy demonstration at city council involving people locking themselves to furniture.
Of which I was not a part.
Which you were not a part of, but you were simply trying to pass on the sacred petitions to the clerk, and I got the bums rush for your trouble, and a special ground's eye view of one of the stone pillars outside.
Yeah, and it has run physical havoc with my life.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to Sergeant Crane.
Pretty seriously injured.
Also, I should point out that on Tuesday morning at 8:15 in Tom Kelly's court, shit kicker Sean Alimi is going to,
hey, Sean,
not to trial necessarily, but to his case of how many felonies can we throw against him to get this damn food server out of town. It comes back to a municipal or a superior, I think they have some sort of a combination of the two courts. And that's 8:15 on Tuesday, so there's lots of stuff happening next week.
Well, this is sort of like medieval Catholic Church. They know how to make saints, don't they? They pick certain people and torture them, and they end up with sainthood. I mean, is we have to wait till this posthumous, or should we just call him Saint Sean now?
Saint Sean, that might be the way to do it. Wow, and of course, folks who are interested, you can actually get food from Food Not Bombs at 1 o'clock. Down at the town clock. That's every Saturday and Sunday, and today is no exception. So if you're hungry and you ain't got no food, wander on down for some great bagels. They actually got chocolate chip bagels down there off times. Good salads, hot soup, and some good company, too. I just want to mention that. If you want to help Food Not Bombs, their phone number is 425-3345. And if you want to help feed the people, which serves on Mondays and Tuesdays down in front of Logos Books, you can give them a call at 425-FEED, F-E-E-D, or 3333. I appreciate your letting me run some commercials right over you there,
all right, Robert.
David.
I do have to sort of get myself in gear here, though.
Well,
I've got our state organizer from out of town coming.
Well, yeah, so anyway, and today go up and check out Rock the Vote at
Hillel
Student Center.
Yeah.
On campus, and tomorrow it's police abuse. So you can watch the police get patted on the back by the Citizens Police Review Board at 5:30, or you can go to SCAN and see what they do with the sleeping ban repeal, or what else is going on down there at 6:30.
Yes on 9.
Sorry.
Yes on 9.
And yes on 9, according to our man David Silva. And then of course on on Tuesday morning, check out Sean at 8:15 and. I guess it's Kelly's court. I think that may be Department 1. I'm not quite sure. You got to check the calendar to see what's going on there. In the afternoon, we got the city council. It's 3:30 and 7, where they're going to try to dash through all kinds of dirt. You don't know anything about any of that stuff, do you, David?
I know Bombay is coming up Tuesday, and I don't know the schedule. I haven't read the item.
Summarize Bombay for us.
Well, the Bombay is the open hole in the green belt to secure the green belt for the city. And it's also a very, very strategic area because it's, west of the university and leads to Graywell Ranch, and, any kind of incursion there is definitely can be disastrous to the Greenbelt concept.
What is being considered?
I don't know exactly what's being considered. I know it's coming from planning. It's something that's being referred from planning. So I would like to have read, I'm sorry I haven't read it before today, Robert.
So we're talking
about... I'd say definitely if you have any time... Check out City Council Tuesday. A big giveaway could happen right, when we think we've had victories here.
3:30.
We have to be very careful with these victories.
3:30 or 7 o'clock?
I don't know.
Right.
Check it out. I wish I could tell you.
And for those who are interested, there are schedules available in the library. And interestingly enough, for those who still don't know what happened at the beach, for the Beach Flats giveaway.
Yeah, I want to know what happened between 12 p.m. and 2 a.m.
Yeah, that meeting on Tuesday went until 2 in the morning, and when I went to the city clerk's office on Friday, they told me they were not going to have an itemized, clear, printed set of what actually happened there until October 27th.
I beg your pardon?
You got it.
Excuse my ass, they have to have that by law within 5 days, 7 days.
Well, they apparently have the law is leaving them behind, or vice versa.
Excuse me. You have to have the action agenda done within 7 days in public.
Well, then we should be able to have that shortly, and I think it's very important to us because, we want to know. I mean, I know that, and the update.
Yeah, there were probably some reports required, I wouldn't be surprised if Celia on that EIR vote, you know, required staff to make certain reports. Requirement of reports is the same as making a conditional vote of approval of
the EIR. There was a lot of concern among those of us who opposed the beach boardwalk giveaway that Celia and Catherine joined in this whole process with their 7-0 vote at the end approving the EIR. But we don't really know what happened until we see the action agenda from the city clerk's office. So we're
knowing Celia and watching her perform in these late hours, you know, when she's up against this wall, she brilliantly sometimes puts a, you know, requirements reports from staff explaining certain inconsistencies, which is makes it conditional. And I would like to see if that's happened now, and if so, we want to stay on top of those conditions.
Well, I noticed at least in two votes earlier in the evening that we had the same 5-2 majority recoalescing the Rotkin majority, where they voted, for example, not to allow the community garden project to guarantee that it would remain where it was, not to allow a public process around La Bahia. And I'm curious how many more 5-2 votes there were throughout the course of the evening.
Yeah. But I watched pretty late, but you know, I just fell asleep.
I guess
I was just exhausted.
Well, let's before all our listeners fall asleep from this gobbledygook between the two of us, I want to thank you, David Silver, for your really informative update. You do a great job.
Well, I wish I was a little more researched this time, but I've been running like crazy this week.
Well, take a breather.
And sick.
Well, bye-bye.
This is your community policing hotline. To report civil unrest, press 1. To report an illegal assembly of two or more people, press 2. To report homeless trespassers on public or private property, press 3. To report terrorist activity in your church, school, or neighborhood, press 4. And thank you for calling your community policing hotline.
Many a first friend. And that was Bob Dylan's Dream. Peter, Paul, and Mary sang that one back in 1970 on album 1700. Boy, long time ago. Still good music. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. You know me, I'm Bathrobe's Peter Robert Nurse, actually in my original blue bathrobe this morning, for all of you who haven't noticed. This is the bathrobe I wore, what was it, 8 years ago when we had the great homeless congress here in 1990, and what, had 200, 300 homeless people marching around, and 500 and 600 red shirts, organized by Carol Boozenhart and other right-wingers opposing homeless rights. And wow, those were the heady days. But these are good days, too, that we're in. It looks like we may get some real changes if we get together and push them. And you heard David Silva talking about negotiations he was trying to get together. It sounds like largely good intentions on the part of a few and bad faith or tokenism on the part of others. It's, of course, I wasn't at the negotiations. I wasn't even informed they were happening in the form they were, the specific form they were. But it shows that even the most well-intentioned negotiations need some real steel and back, some real folks doing the kinds of things that Vocal Billy is doing, which is sleeping out publicly, challenging the laws, raising his voice. At the Cooper House ceremonies that we played a little bit about that happened around the Cooper House ceremony. The Cooper House, of course, was the building downtown across from the Cinema 9, torn down days after the earthquake, and over the objections of many people as part of the rampant redeveloper mentality that has now, of course, completely captured the Santa Cruz City Council. They were doing a publicly announced dirt-throwing, groundbreaking construction beginning at the Cooper House a couple weeks ago, a week and a half ago. And I happened upon it, and they tried to force me to leave. I actually did have some tape of this, so I don't really have it handy at the moment. Now, what I have for you, however, are conversations that happened a bit later. We had the mayor speaking. We have Celia Cirillo speaking, one of the crucial city staff people. He's a redevelopment person. I get all these people a bit confused, I have to admit. And you'll hear me commenting on what's going on with another uninvited guest, although, frankly, the whole public was invited to this. It was in the paper, and it was merchants invited people from their stores. So the idea that certain activists should be excluded was preposterous. So it's really a lesson to be learned here. When they tell you to leave a public function, you tell them, no, thank you. It's much better if you have a tape recorder with you, of course, but have a witness with you. Don't be intimidated by big bruisers with hard hats or big badges or business suits. Just speak loudly and clearly and make sure other more objective people are present to witness what you're saying. Anyway, here's a little more of that Cooper House groundbreaking.
Were invited in by which two women? Over by the fence. I don't recognize them, but yeah, I mean, there's no sign that it's not open to the public, and they have individuals who are going up and informing people, or informing me of that. I'm glad that we ignored it. So we have, this is very fitting. These are the two clowns that are going to bury the Beach Flats residents. And they're doing it here, too. Yeah, we got Kennedy, Matthews, and unfortunately Celia Scott wearing hard hats, about to do a little dirt shoveling. It's a little too dirty for me to deal with. Maybe we should get back to the Helena thing.
No, it doesn't. She look good in a hard hat.
Which one? The lady in Celia Cirillo. She's the one who's, you know, who does the behind-the-scenes staff work for a lot of this shit, and I don't know who he is, the man in the middle.
Obviously, they don't know how to shovel.
Right. Well, they'll get good union workers to do it, and then they'll give people $6-an-hour jobs once they get people in place. These guys are just too much.
Very symbolic.
So you were in Helena, and what happened in Helena?
Well, it was the capital city of the state. It was one of the oldest towns in the state, and a very beautiful one because it was wealthy. And in the late 60s, the local residents heard talk about, the government is going to give so much money to our community to have it refurbished, redone, made to look nice. Considering it's the capital city, we should make a good impression on folks, you know, like tourists. And so all our old buildings maybe shouldn't be here. And maybe we should take out some of the existing streets that we have and make nice wide four-lane thoroughfares right through the middle of old downtown, which followed a creek,
right,
which was called Last Chance Gulch.
Really?
Because that's where the gold was discovered by four Georgians. I think they were deserters from the Confederacy, because it was discovered in 1864, the gold, that is, by these four Georgians. And since the Civil War was still going on strong in 1864, they must have been deserters. But anyway, we had a very historic town, and architecturally one of the most beautiful towns anywhere in the U.S. And I think if they had preserved Helena, it might have been the finest Greenwich Village west of Greenwich Village. It certainly had the capacity for being a very unique town of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Had the right people come in at the right time. A lot of the local residents did try to resist what happened, but actually about seven realtors became millionaires out of that fiasco that turned Helena into a somewhat ugly, modernistic, futuristic nightmare. And all the lovely ornate Rococo, Baroque, Victorian buildings that we had in the downtown area were torn down, and we were given nice linear, square, tasteless buildings in its place. And where a lot of the old residences of the downtown area, which of course naturally housed the poor people and the Indians and so on, those residences were also deemed too shabby to be left standing. So as in the beach area, where there's a lot of poorer class people living, Helena's downtown residents were all pushed out, let's be quite direct about it.
How big a town was Helena?
Helena was, in those days, about 25,000.
Now it's
not much more than that. I doubt if it's 3,000 or 5,000. But all the poor people were pushed out, and new housing, this was the fun thing, new housing was proposed, and the architects gave us some chicken coop-like structures. They're just half of the house, you know, the roof goes up only halfway. Instead of having a rafter and a roof down the other side, they left it kind of like that. And they stuck these kind of houses all over, where they had taken out little log cabins and little brick houses and cottages of the poorer people of the last century, and replaced them all with the ugliest architecture you've ever seen. And of course, we were promised that this would bring in opportunity and new business, and that Helena would be reborn. Helena is now about the dullest, deadest town you've ever seen. Nothing happening in the downtown. And all the promises that were made about the revival of Helena
seem to have come to naught.
Seem to have come to naught. Well, 30 years and still not picked up, I guess we could say in retrospect that they didn't keep their promises. How strange and unpredictable. And I'm sorry if this happens to Santa Cruz, because I think there's still something left of this town that's unique and interesting.
Who's the city council candidate? Linda Steiner.
Which one?
Yeah. She's the downtown, the Beach Boardwalk's baby on the coming in on the council, and the one most likely to win.
She wants it or she's against it?
Oh, she's in favor of it. She's in favor of it.
Well, I've only recently been down in your boardwalk area. I've only been in town a few days, but I've gone down there, and it's lovely as it is. I've seen the houses that so-called in much need of repair, and Helena was like that once too. But I still believe that if people were given paintbrushes and sandpaper and tools, that and given the requirement of fixing up their homes or losing them, that would work a lot better than millions of dollars, taxpayers' dollars, spent on highfalutin folk programs where a few high-class businessmen benefit and people get moved away from their homes and the life of the town dies.
And your name again is Leaf.
I have a Hindu name, Tulasi Nadan. It's a lot for most Americans to wrap their tongue around. But because of what happened in my town, I moved myself halfway around the world and now live in India.
Thank you, Leif.
Thank you.
This is your community policing hotline. To report a crime, press 1. To report the suspicion of a crime, press 2. To report the intent to commit a crime, press 3. To report suspicion of the intent to commit a crime, press 4. And thank you for calling your community policing hotline.
Well, it's around 7:25 on, what is it, Wednesday evening, the 7th, and we're on Pacific Avenue outside of Shen's Gallery and Artisans, talking to Berkeley Billy, I believe.
How are you doing, Robert?
Billy, you're continuing your vigil at the post office, but not too many people are there with you, right?
Nah, no one's really been showing up. There's not much solidarity in this town as far as I can see. I think it's a little too laid back here. They need to have things shook up a bit, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's just too complacent, comfortably numb, we might say.
Right. That's my complaint about the Fed Center's below back. So this would make your sixth night tonight?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's been very smooth. You know, it's kind of a nice place to stay. No tickets, no cops, no nothing.
And no other people, apparently.
And no other people, yeah.
Now, I noticed you have quite a shiner on your right eye that's beginning to come
back.
I think you may have talked to us about this, but remind us what this was all about.
Oh, yeah, there's this little Rat Pack gang that hangs out at the shelter down there. They decided they were going to steal my Steinberg guitar, and I had a witness that saw him get into the truck with it. So I confronted him about it, and I got too close to this one punk, and he kind of sucker-punched me. I shouldn't have got too close, that's my fault. Anyway, it's starting to open back up again. I got two eyes to see again. Kind of nice.
And you're planning to go down to a meeting at the Homeless Community Resource Center tomorrow? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I was going to go to one tonight. It's got all the church, you know, church people that come in there, but they closed that one. They don't let the public come in and talk on that one. So tomorrow night is supposed to be some kind of open meeting, so I'm going to go to that one. And I heard something real interesting today. I was sitting down waiting for the breakfast thing, and Karen Gillette showed up with some other guy, and they're standing there talking kind of in whispers, you know, but they were pretty close to me, so it's kind of hard not to hear it. And she's talking about, they're talking about these guys dealing heroin and stuff like that, you know, and said something about how there might be a problem with that, and I said, oh yeah, you think this is a problem? I pulled my shades off and showed her my eye. And
what did she say then?
She goes, well, did you call the police or did you do this? I said, no, I did not call the police. I'm not some kind of snitch, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't do that. I said, I'd like to see people around here do their job. You ain't got no security here. She goes, well, you just want to be a victim, don't you? You know, I said, what? I said, I'm no victim. What's up with this, Karen? You know, I think she's become extremely complacent and comfortably numb in her little softy position she's got. She used to not be like that about 3 years ago, but she seems to have changed a whole lot. You know, I guess it's the money. I don't know. You know, but
so what was the ultimate outcome of your conversation with the head of the Homeless Community Resource Center? Indeed, she's actually the executive director of this new organization that runs not just the Homeless Community Resource Center, but the
ISSP Interface Satellite Shelter Program, and Community House.
I didn't know all that.
Yeah,
but
she's the big cheese.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She's kind of moved on up the ladder a bit, I guess. Huh? Well, you know what they say, the higher up you go, the farther you fall. But she's just kind of stormed away from me, you know. It's like she's doing me a favor even being in my presence, you know. What's up with that? You know, she's here to serve the people. You know, it's not there for the people to serve her. You know, but she seems to have got it back afterwards here somehow. I don't know. There's a real problem with that as far as I can see. But tomorrow night, they're going to have an open meeting. Tonight's a closed meeting with all the church people. Now, I don't know why it's closed, but you'd think it'd be open so everybody can have a little chit-chat. But, you know, I guess they don't want it like that. But tomorrow night's going to be an open meeting, so I'm going to go there, and hopefully I can get either you or Becky to come in there with me so that I got a little backup in here when I start talking about these security procedures they have out there. Because a lot of people are really losing a lot of stuff out there, getting stolen, and all the employees there just seem to turn a blind eye to it and go, oh, wow, man, that's too bad, you know. And there's a whole gang of people out there dealing all kinds of drugs, and they don't seem to even really care too much about it. It doesn't seem to matter to them. I guess you got to be sanctioned to deal drugs out there, because if I deal any drugs out there, they kick me out of property. So what's up with that? You know what I mean? So I want to get some answers from Karen and Mike and all the people out there.
Is Karen due at this meeting tomorrow?
I should hope so. You know what I mean? She's getting paid to be there. You know, she's. I don't see her there very much for being paid so much. I don't know what the heck she's doing.
But there was some talk that Mike Bustos, who's now the new kind of head of the Homeless Community Resource Center, the position that Karen used to have before she kind of did this coup and took over the entire program. How's he doing? It's been said that he's more sensitive to people.
Well, I don't know. I don't ever see him. You know, it's just like Karen. You know, they're kind of like ghost images. You know what I mean? If it was me and I was running the thing, I'd be there all day long and be checking stuff out. You know, that's what a manager does. A manager keeps an eye on things. I'm a manager. I manage a hotel and I keep an eye on stuff. I gotta make sure people don't steal things and stuff like that. You know, employees. I keep an eye on them all. And that isn't what I call management. I call that mismanagement. You know, so.
Mismanagement.
Yeah,
in this case.
Yes, maybe.
Perhaps missing management.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Missing management.
Missing management. Exactly.
And the update on that story was that there apparently was no meeting on Thursday. Instead, Billy, Oscar, and Becky went to the Linda Steinau kickoff ceremony. I guess it was already kicked off. The greenback ceremony, where they were trying to raise a little money for that impoverished Downtown Association Steinau campaign with the able help of Deadweight Darrell Darling. And Linda did not want to talk to them about homeless issues, nor did Darrell Darling, who tried to get them to leave, according to Becky Johnson, 5 times. But there was a successful communication, apparently, within the next few days between Billy and Mike Bustos. And he learned that the people who had stolen, or had been informed had stolen his guitar, had been 86th from the property. So that sounds like, and that was at the initiative, I believe, of Mike Bustos. Now perhaps it could have been Karen Gillette. And again, it's hard to tell what the truth of the whole story is. One's only getting one side here. Karen rarely returns my phone calls, and I admit, though, I didn't call her. Mike hasn't returned my phone calls in several weeks. I've been trying to reach him repeatedly without success, and I don't think there's any hostility between the two of us. I've just been having a little difficulty getting through on the phone line. Well, I have an article that I ran into last night that really struck me, and I want to read it to you. It's from the Anderson Valley Advertiser of September 23rd. This is a weekly paper out of Boonville, Northern California, which is really kind of a radical paper. They have some unfortunate opinions on homelessness, which suck big time, but they also have some very good work on other subjects. And this is the story. It's a review of a book called The Selling, C-E-L-L-I-N-G, like in prison cells of America, an inside look at the U.S. prison industry, edited by Daniel Burton Rose, with the editors of Prison Legal News, Dan Pins and Paul Wright, Common Courage Press, 1998, 263 pages. This is a book review. The 49 essays and 8 introductions gathered in The Selling of America, an inside look at the U.S. prison industry, are the work of over a dozen prisoners, a half dozen journalists, activists, and a federal judge. The book was edited by two Washington State prisoners, Dan Pins and Paul Wright, along with Daniel Burton Rose, a student at Oberlin College. Almost all the essays are culled from the remarkable Prison Legal News, a staid-looking publication started in 1990 and produced monthly from Penn's and Wright's prison cells, 12 issues for $15 for prisoners, $20 to $50 for everyone else. Send checks to Prison Legal News, 2400 Northwest 80th Street, 148, Seattle, Washington, 98117. If you want this number, give me a call, by the way, after the show at 423-HUFF. I'll give it to you. They described PLN, Prison Legal News, as the only wholly independent, uncensored, prison-written, edited, and produced publication in the U.S. That's prisoner-written. Two decades into an historically unprecedented prison boom, incarceration rates 6 to 8 times greater than any other industrial society, the U.S. is still the leader in violent crime. I'll interrupt this briefly to take a phone call. Whoops, sorry about that caller. You can call back if you want to catch me again. I only caught that ring toward the very end. We're reading a review of the book, The Selling of America. The U.S. is still the leader in violent crime. The Selling of America and Prison Legal Notes are essential resources for anyone attempting to understand what criminologist Elliot Curie calls the most thoroughly implemented government social program of our time, short of major wars. As The Selling of America simply documents, this is a very lucrative social program built on pseudo-tough soundbites, issuing in crackpot pragmatist prison policies and programs. The essays in The Selling of America are in the tradition of the muckraking journalists of the progressive period. From their cells, these prisoners relying on public media, court documents, scholarly work, and a dense network of prison correspondents throughout the country present a report on the amazing American prison system in its labyrinthine complexity, an institution that has moved from the backwaters portrayed in Cool Hand Luke to the center of national life. The essays are divided into 8 sections, beginning with the new politics of crime and ending with prisoner struggles and rebellions. The essays collected under Working for the Man are likely to incite competitive anxieties in Beijing when they read in The Global Economy Behind Ohio Prison Walls by Danny Chahill that Unibase, a data processing company, pays Ohio state prison inmates 47 cents an hour in 18 programs across the state. On the other hand, oil ministers from Saudi Arabia will feel more at home during business visits to Houston after reading Dan Penn's on Houston, Texas, Death Penalty Capital of the USA, where you will read, if you are put on death row by the government in this country, there is a better than 1 in 10 chance that your case was tried in Houston, Texas. The mood of the prison essayists is somber. This is a period of near total abandonment of prisoners, writes Ray Luke Levasseur from his maximum security cell in Florence, Arizona. He concludes with the question, has the current situation become a permanent and expanding part of a larger nightmare we are all getting sucked into? Judging from the pages of The Selling of America, the answer seems to be yes. Catalogs of cruel indifference and brutality toward nearly 1.8 million prisoners strut brazenly through The Selling of America. Arizona Governor Fife Symington summarized his vision for his state's prisons to wealthy donors at a fundraising dinner. It will be a hellhole to which no man will ever want to go. Governor William Weld of Massachusetts informed the citizenry that a stay in prison, quote, should replicate a tour of the circles of hell, unquote. Alabama Governor Fab James announced the return of chain gangs on a radio talk show. Shortly afterwards, Governor James Prison Chief Sam Lewis informed death row inmates that the reinstitution of the chain gang will give them an opportunity to improve their status while on death row. Those not sufficiently inspired by the opportunity, the memo continues, quote, shall be forcibly removed from their cells, unquote, taken to the worksite, and chained to a post. Journalist Noel Hanrahan describes how death row inmates in Pennsylvania are locked down all but 5 hours a week and are allowed 2 non-contact visits per week. Mumia Abu-Jamal, with 2 characteristically eloquent essays in The Selling of America, is given a full-body cavity strip search before and after each visit, where he is completely separated from his visitors by steel and glass. While politicians seem accurately to calculate that the voting public loves such hellfire, it is puzzling that more joy is not taken in the results arising from the vision. The catalog of prisoner beatings and shooting deaths, decades-long immersions in tiny isolation cells, horrible food, super-exploited labor, denial of long-held amenities like weights, should be expected to raise hosannas of praise from a grateful public. Instead, many essays in a section titled The Distorted Lens, The Corporate Media Filter of Crime and Justice, show the political class and what the editors call prisoncrats as anxious to control media spin as Pentagon spokespersons during the Gulf War. In an even-handed essay, The Straw That Broke the Camel's Back, the 1993 Lucasville Easter Uprising, prison participant John Perotti describes how 435 prisoners took over L Block of the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility. When it was over, 9 prisoners and 1 guard were dead. Prison administration focused appliant media, quote, on various violent acts committed by prisoners during the 11-day siege. Ignored were events leading to the riot, including a 38-page prisoner-authored petition to Amnesty International, accompanied by over 200 pages of exhibits detailing brutality by guards and many other institutional flaws at the prison. Nor had the many letters and petitions to civil rights groups, the FBI, or the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice brought relief. All to no avail. A riot was inevitable, writes Perotti. Along with the thinning of civil libertarians' voices outside the walls, the last 2 decades have seen the near disappearance of important witnesses within, such as academic researchers and clergy with morals and courage to speak out. However, I have been impressed with critiques of prison conditions by prison ministries, headed by ex-Watergate criminal, now Minister Chuck Colson. Attorneys, likewise, seldom speak out on prison issues. Remaining independent witnesses include journalists and a few tiny prison activist groups. In California bans media interviews with prisoners, Willie Wisely concisely narrates how California's political and prison leadership hamstring journalistic access to prisoners through an opportunistic misreading of 1994 legislation stripping inmates' rights. With characteristic prevarication and tabloid iconography, this media ban was explained by the Assistant Secretary of the Youth and Adult Corrections Agency, J.P. Tremblay, as a way to protect us from the sight of prisoners being given, quote, a public forum in which they can espouse their often sociopathic philosophies, unquote. The Department of Corrections held a hearing in June 1996.